Many thanks, Chair, and greetings to all the members of this important committee. It's an honour to be with you today. Rather like the two previous presenters, I come here with, in a sense, a long memory of this debate. In 1995, I was fairly young, writing my first postgraduate thesis on land reform during the time of the constitutional negotiations. I remember very strikingly the contrast between, it wasn't just farmers who were objecting around the question of property rights, it was also the mines and the banks. We very clearly were thinking not just about land, but about property in its broadest sense. So that's the first point that I wanted to just raise, which is in all of the deliberations of the Constitutional Review Committee and now this current committee, I think that there's a very clear need for a clear logic and a messaging around whether land and other forms of property are to be treated differently, and if so, why and how. So that was my first point. But I wanted just to reflect on that early process. In my PhD thesis, I looked at the constitution-making process, and particularly Section 25(5), the right of access to land on an equitable basis, which actually arose from a group of ANC-aligned lawyers who argued that if opposition parties wanted a Bill of Rights and a property clause that would protect property, in fact they wanted to subvert that idea that a property clause is about defining private property. Of course, there is no right to private property in Section 25. There is no. Section 25(1) is framed as a negative right. It's merely the process through which property can be removed, or one may be deprived of property. So what I thought was very interesting was this argument about from ANC lawyers at the time, and I'm going to quote here, who argued in favor of a regime of property rights for the propertyless. And this was to counterbalance the property rights debate, which had centered on the right of those who hold property to retain it. Instead, the constitutional package, this is from Jeff Budlander, the constitutional package would make the landless and homeless in a position where they could make a claim of right rather than a petition for largesse, right? So this is about people enforcing and claiming rights. And so in this way, even among those who had originally argued against the idea of having a property clause, particularly remember it was the National Party and the Democratic Party that wanted a property clause, and the ANC initially said, no, this can be covered under the common law. But eventually this idea was adopted by the ANC. Among those who had initially argued against a property clause, the idea was born of using a constitutional rights framework to impose a positive obligation on the state to provide suitable land and housing for the landless and homeless. It would empower them to press their claims and shape the behavior of state officials to facilitate a responsive land reform. And then I go back to a quote again from Budlander, which says, the only way, this is the thinking at the time, the only way to achieve a true balance between the rights of property holders and propertyless, those who own and those who don't own property, is to weaken existing property rights as a matter of deliberate policy. That was the thinking. So we have these rights. And in that sense, that would be my perspective that I want to share with you, which is that I think that there's been a lot of constitution blaming, but in many respects, if you just look at the deprivation clause, 25(1), the rest of this is all about how you can expropriate property. It's the mandate for redistribution, restitution, tenure reform. And I would argue that what is also important here is that the compensation requirements, as we know, are not that compensation must be paid in cash immediately, or at anything related to market value. In fact, we just don't have the jurisprudence. And I remember Judge Dichan Moseneke, when he launched his book, I think it was last year or the year before, opining that the Constitutional Court cannot be proactive in this. There haven't been any cases. So we can't develop the law if there aren't any cases. So I think that that's important. Also to reflect again that Section 25(4) specifically says that property is not limited to land. And then we have 5, 6, and 7, which in a sense are the three pillars of land reform, and then 8, which I characterize as the override clause. And I think that that's an important area to be looking at, which is that no provision of the section may impede the state from taking legislative and other measures. So the compensation requirement that doesn't say that it must be in cash or upfront, but the requirement that compensation is just and equitable cannot be a mechanism to impede the state. Let's just clarify then. I think that it is important to bear in mind the most comprehensive review of the land reform process to date, which was the high-level panel report. What we know from that is, firstly, the Bill of Rights mandates land expropriation in the interests of land reform. It does not require market-related compensation. Any compensation that is to be paid should be just and equitable, balancing the rights and interests. And any expropriation is to be addressed on a case-by-case basis. So one of the important reasons why expropriation legislation is really needed is to break a deadlock. Right, so we've seen it with our restitution claims, with our labor tenant claims, that if the state does not have a credible opportunity to expropriate, we are giving essentially a landowner veto on the process. So land reform is held up. So I think that we need to be very clear about whether the expropriation, the purpose of expropriation is to break deadlock, to speed things up, or to do things cheaply. Now, I think that we know that at least for the initial period, it's not going to speed up. So I think that that is an important factor to take into account. But we clearly do need jurisprudence. So my view is that the problem isn't the Constitution. The problem is that we failed to use the Constitution. I'm going to outline four scenarios for how this issue can be addressed. The first scenario is what some people mean by land expropriation without compensation, and that is state custodianship of all land. Vesting custodianship in the state would be a deprivation of property rights, and it would be in terms of a law of general application. And we have precedents for this. We have the Agri-SA case on the MPRDA, which said that actually the vesting of mineral rights in the state is not an expropriation, and you can't seek compensation. It is a deprivation, and it's a deprivation under a law of general application. So it's not discriminatory. So the Agri-SA lost that case, right? We've also seen it with the issue of water, which has also been vested in the state. So for some people, this is what they see as land expropriation without compensation. It is already allowed for under Section 25(1), that would be state custodianship. But let's be clear, this is the perspective of a minority party, not the majority party. And importantly also, it doesn't address the issue of redistribution. So I think that there is popular perception that if the state gets land for free, it will redistribute it for free. And that is not the case. That is not current policy. So regardless of how and through what mechanisms, whether consensual sales by the market or expropriation with or without compensation, the state is not giving land for free under redistribution. It does under restitution. It does not under redistribution. So we still have a state that's trying to extract rent from people, regardless of how it acquires that. So that's scenario one, state custodianship. Second scenario would be expropriation without compensation in all cases. Now, I haven't seen this very clearly articulated, but there are some people who seem to think that in every case where the state is going to acquire land, it wants to expropriate and it will never pay compensation. And I think that this is really not an option on the table. It would mean treating the poor in the same way as we treat the rich. It would mean treating white and black owners with different histories in the same way, and all being denied compensation. And, you know, I'm so struck because we've been involved with engaging with the Kolobeni case, where people are demanding a right to free, prior, and informed consent on any transactions, don't even want to get into negotiations around compensation. So we need to be clear that we're making law for all South Africans. So we need to have a varied approach, that is my view. It's very difficult to see how it could pass constitutional muster. It would violate Sections 1 and 36, the Limitations Clause, and I think that the judge already mentioned that there's some kinds of amendments which, even with a majority, a constitutionally required majority would be ruled out by the judiciary. So scenario three is expropriation without compensation in some cases. So we need to be clear that the notion of what is just and equitable compensation has not been tested. Many constitutional experts argue that the state may pay zero compensation where it's just and equitable to do so. And we now see from the 21st of December the expropriation bill in section 12.3 clarifies five circumstances where zero compensation or nil compensation could be paid. But that's not exclusive. It includes those five categories. So we still need to develop this area of law. So what in my view is needed is our new expropriation bill being debated and passed into policy, being passed into law. We need policy, we need regulations, and we need test cases to clarify the compensation regime. Even doing all of that doesn't actually require amendment to the Constitution. But we now have the report of the Constitutional, the Joint CRC from the 15th of November, which has this fascinating conclusion, which is that we must make explicit what is already implicit in Section 25. There's a political demand for it. My view is that in terms of the letter of the law, it's not required, but there clearly is a political demand. So I think that there is a need for amendment, and this could be, you know, it could be done in various ways. There's Section 25 2B, and there's Section 25.8. So those would be, in my understanding, and I must make a disclaimer here, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a political scientist. But I have been looking at this issue for some time. And but my understanding, and I've discussed this with a few people who are advocates and who work on property rights, and you know, I think that there is the possibility of a clarificatory amendment, but I like the idea of framing it in a more clearly policy-directed way, for instance, along the lines of the preamble that was suggested by the judge. So so those, in a sense, are the four options: the state custodianship, expropriation without compensation in all cases, both of which I think are unfeasible politically. Third option is expropriation in some cases without an amendment, or expropriation in some cases with an amendment. And I think that politically now we're sitting with the expropriation without compensation with an amendment. I want to raise another issue that was also debated in September last year when the Joint CRC was meeting. And that is that it's very clear that the problems with land reform have not been that the state doesn't have sufficient power in law. It's the fact that citizens do not have sufficient power to enforce the rights that already are sitting in Section 25. Now, one of the ideas that emerges from experience elsewhere, particularly Brazil, is the idea that land has a social function. It must fulfill a social function. It is not merely a commodity. And the Brazilian Constitution of 1988 has strong provisions for land to serve a social function. Clauses 2 and 23 establish a right to property and then assert that property must perform its social function. And although it's not explicitly explained within the Constitution, the social function of land has been understood through the legal process there to mean that legislation on and the allocation of land should result in more equitably distributed land. And it should also distribute the benefits and disadvantages of land in a more fair way. And so this means that actually it doesn't go as far as decriminalizing land occupations, but it does say that where there is land that is not fulfilling its social function, the state has stronger powers and citizens have stronger powers to assert their competing claims. So I think that that's a very interesting possibility that should be part of the negotiating mix. So let's just, I'm not going to take much longer, but I want to clarify that in my view, the consultative process last year was very illuminating. in a sense, it asked the wrong question to the wrong people. So what we should have been asking is to the executive, why have you not used your powers to expropriate in the interests of land reform? But we didn't ask that question. We asked ordinary citizens, do you want the constitution to change? And that was interpreted as, would you like free land? And people would have said, yes. But it was interpreted in that way. So I think that in many respects, the challenge is from the legislature to the executive, which is challenging the state on its non-implementation of Section 25, and that's what we heard very clearly as a message from the high-level panel. Now, I just want to say a few things about what I think could be useful processes forward. Clearly, you're going to discuss the merits of and the wording of a potential amendment to Section 25. And the question of whether it should just be permissive, should it merely permit, because of course it already permits. So should it just clarify the permission, or should it strengthen the interests of citizens to gain access to land? So Section 25.5, which is, of course we've got 5, 6 and 7, frame our three programs of land reform. And Section 25.5, we do not have post-apartheid legislation on this. So we have Restitution Act, we have various tenure reform laws, but we do not have a law that says what is the right of access to land on an equitable basis. So my view is that there's a package that we need to be thinking of, and this requires a political process far beyond the mandate of this committee right now, but I think it's worth putting on record. So other than a change in the Constitution, or in addition to the change in the Constitution, what would be the good signs that we're moving forward? Firstly, we need to expedite the expropriation bill, negotiate around particularly the definition of categories of land under Section 12.3. We need to develop compensation policy, because I think that the important issue that we've picked up in our presidential panel is we've met with the Office of the Valuer General, and we've looked at the Property Valuations Act, and what's concerning here is that there is an approach to compensation that has no basis in law, and it hasn't been tested in the courts. What we have found is that the OVG takes market value and then adds productive value based on a certain commodity or crop. They add them together and divide by two, and that is their offer. And the result of this is that restitution and redistribution have been grinding down to a halt. In the Eastern Cape last financial year, there were two farms were acquired, because in most cases, property owners will say, no, you're offering me below market value, I'm not taking it. So I think that we need to have clear compensation policy to back up the expropriation bill that will become law. And then that compensation policy needs to provide some clarity that will then be tested in courts, and we can get some jurisprudence. The third point that I want to make is that we do need to start thinking around this idea of a redistribution bill that would frame the redistribution process, but also provide overarching guidance on the land reform process. And importantly, it must operationalize what is access to land on an equitable basis, and what are the methods through which a citizen can claim that right. In other words, what are the local planning processes, what is the beneficiary selection process, how is it transparent and fair? We do not have such provisions, so I think that the redistribution bill is crucial. And the fourth point that I want to make is, and it again relates to, I think, quite an incisive point from Judge Albie Sachs, which is that we have a situation in our country where the majority of people have no recorded rights. We call them off-register rights. Everybody in the communal areas, everyone in informal settlements, backyard shacks, farm workers and dwellers, labor tenants. So we have a system of property rights that is in fact working for the minority. We have cadastral systems, surveys, deeds registry, but it works for a minority of citizens. And I think here again, this idea of having a land records bill is very important, because it would allow the local level recording of property rights other than private ownership, and would over time incrementally start to support those rights, even if they overlap. So if I'm a long-term labor tenant or farm dweller, I have a property right that I should be able to record and document what property I have access to and what my historical and customary use of that property has been. And that should be a recognizable and registrable right. The first case then, let me just summarize. The expropriation bill, a compensation policy, a redistribution bill, a land records bill. We need to have test cases to take to the Constitutional Court. And, because these are going to be contested, it's really crucial to get good cases that are going to provide the right kind of guidance. I wanted to also mention that our panel is considering asking possibly a retired judge for an opinion on this question of just and equitable and how it would be interpreted, clearly because we need to differentiate between somebody who inherited property from 200 years ago, benefited from state subsidies throughout apartheid, and perhaps is not using the lands profitably now, versus somebody who bought it on the market last year. You know, so we need to have a spectrum. So our view is that we need to think about a spectrum of compensation models ranging from zero, particularly where the owner doesn't have effective occupation and use of that land. So we're thinking labor tenants, inner city buildings, informal settlements. There are a variety, and there's speculative land holding and so on. These are all spelled out in Section 12.3 of the Expropriation Bill. But we do need to clarify this. And I want to just say something, small, on the restitution issue. The 1913 cut-off date is a regular grievance. So on the one hand, I think that in the context of the very poor showing with land redistribution, many people are relying on the restitution claims-making process because they don't feel like they're getting anywhere with redistribution. So I think that there's a real crisis. In our panel process, we're of the view that, and I hope I'm not misrepresenting the panel, but at least I'll talk for myself, that this that restitution has become a political liability. In the sense that political promises have been made that are not going to be realized anytime soon. The high-level panel process saw commissioned research which showed that even to resolve the old claims submitted by 1998 will take another 35 years, and to resolve the expected total number of new claims would take, at the current pace, a further 143 years. Then last week we see that the budget for the National Office of the Commission has been slashed by 30%, and we know that the whole process is going to slow down further. So I think that we need to be very clear that restitution is more expensive and slow than redistribution. Because there's no onus of proof, people just need to express demand for land. There's no need for archival work, legal representation, and so on. So I think that we need to look at how to expedite this. My colleague, Advocate Tembeka Nwokatobi, put it pretty well when he came to visit the University of Western Cape. He said, "I'm black, I'm South African, I don't own property. Why should I have to prove that I was dispossessed? You know, that my ancestors weren't dispossessed." It's clear. You know, so I think that while of course people do have a right in the Constitution to restitution, I think that facilitating redistribution is going to meet political demand so much better. And I want to wrap up, but I want to just mention finally that I think that on the one hand there is a lot of expectation of this process that people think they're going to get land for free, but at the same time we know that dispossession is happening in various categories of our land, farm workers, people in communal areas. This is ongoing. So we have a problem not just of a legacy of apartheid-era dispossession, but it's continuing, and it's mostly poor and black people who are being dispossessed and who are typically not being paid any kind of compensation in many cases. So I think that we need to keep our eyes on that issue. So thank you very much for the opportunity. Just to emphasize again that I think that whatever happens with the constitutional amendment, and I can see 25.2b and 25.8 are possible areas for amendment, I wanted to emphasize this idea about the social function of land and the fact that whatever happens with the constitution, we need a package, including the expropriation bill, land records bill, redistribution bill, test cases, and of course we need to strengthen our institutions. And I think that that's an open question about our institutional configuration and whether or not particularly the silos that separate rural development and land reform on the one hand from agriculture, forestry and fisheries, if, is that is that dysfunctional and do we need to find a new model? And also the integration more closely of the commission into the department, which I think has been a long-standing question about the that relationship. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ruth. And I'll add in your process that one of the things the panel picked up was also about land administration. because that would also be an ongoing matter, which is indeed another gap in our system. And I think all three of you have emphasized the issue of policy in certain areas, the issue of a legislative agenda which might arise out of this process, and at the same time, again, on the issue you are raising, all three of you, maybe not in the same way, but the dangers of opening up other elements which might cause dispossession once more, and how to deal with overlapping rights. Because while we may in our minds be thinking of rural, but you've got the same scenario in the urban, particularly your shack backyard dwellers, if I were to call it that way, is another case in point. And lodgers. I actually was, I've been doing a lot of literature review on the issue of land, that actually there's a category that has been very in existence in our land rights regime in the country, where you've had even among African communities the system of rentals and lease. They were called lodgers, and if you were to go back to Driefontein, that has been very common. And I think the case of Sono and others in the Limpopo, when a particular claim was being resolved, that issue came out very well, because as people were applying for the claim, and when it was about to be resolved, the six families who actually had acquired that land posed the question, why are we being lumped together with tenants? Says we're not denying that these people stayed here, but they stayed as our tenants because we felt they were being evicted from the land, and now you're actually equating those rights to ours. So I think this principle of overlapping rights on the same land is something that we must deal with. The issue you're raising about lack of policy on compensation, which may be one of the reasons that we are having a frustration in society. The non-clarity on how you interpret just and equitable may be another case. And one of the cases, the issue we are raising that relates to Section 25, which I'll say subsection 3, that deals with what you would provide for in implementing that just an equitable redress, the pointed issue that in my view you have just raised. How do you deal with somebody who might have got whatever subsidy which are not in record? And that's the issue of land administration, because you will find it nowhere in the deeds registry, you will find it nowhere in the land bank, which was only promulgated later in the Agricultural Credit Board. So what do you do with subsidies that were paid from 1913, which you don't even have a record as a factor that you must look at? But also, what do you do with somebody who bought land from that person who got a subsidy? And then I think that's the point that Ruthie are raising about deeper reflection on this issue of just and equitable. Members, we've had the presentation. Any questions, comments to Ruth? Honourable Mwuni?
Chair, thanks. I do confess to be interacting with Prof. Hall at least once per quarter or per semester. in better part of the flow of her presentation, I think we must appreciate and agree. I know she should have an idea that will differ sharply on restitution, and her being here as an expert to advise, she should, and also as an intellectual in her own right and strong state, it's fine. But that we may need to engage. One, restitution is not a numbers issue. It's a substantive issue. It's a rights issue. I'm trying to extract a copy of that Concord judgment of 28 July 2016, where Judge Matlanga, with the whole concurrence of Concord judges, actually penned down. They are very, very clear, unanimous, and unequivocal that restitution is a fundamental. But in the body of land activists and intelligentsia in that space, it seems to be juxtaposed, and I am inviting comment here in that sense. It's not a numbers issue. It is a substantive issue of rights, issue of emancipation or change and liberation in society. But that's one aspect that's flawed. The other one, Chair, on the same restitution issue, it's like if you take the car, if you juxtapose the role of the mirrors to the role of the engine to the role of the tires, and this is what I find high-level intellectuals making this mistake, that we start juxtaposing 10-year security to redistribution to restitution. They different aspects of the portfolio of land reform, and one performs its own space. So in one meeting at my own home politically, I then asked the high-level leaders I met with, I asked them, if you redistribute without restituting, whose land will you redistribute? And the legal minds in the room may even help to say, so this person whose land you are redistributing, why do you have decided to keep in abeyance restitution? So this person comes to the fore, and it's an inalienable right. And this person says, no. It's a good thing to redistribute, but they are redistributing my land. And I'll just cut it to the last aspect, Chair, of this argument for restitution that I think is so unfortunate that intelligentsia, in the general sense, really, not hard sense, seem to be shying away from restitution because it's delaying, because 19,000 cases. I work with this every week. We are at less than 6,000 cases of the 1998 cases that are now standing unsettled, less than 6,000. But even one high-level associate professor tweeted last week and said 19,000. And it's very sad, because if we go the numbers route on a substantive issue, but still code numbers extremely, extremely wrongly. But I asked Chair, may I invite Prof. Hall to really comment on clinics, on schools, on roads, on electricity, on access to water. If you quantify, how far are we there? But if we do the quantitative method here, remember 13% of the land remained in the traditional custodianship. Now, there's argument that it's between 9 and 11% that has since been redistributed. If you add to 13, that's about 24%. There's general consensus that plus minus 6 to 8% can be attributed to those people who chose money. No, we no longer want to go there. We're okay here in Kuguletu. Therefore, compensate us financially. And is it fair if I say by estimate we are at about 30%? That now you would say, in terms of however slow the process is, but as I have tried to quantify in a scientific manner, we're at about 30%. And so to what extent can we judge success? Can we just say there has been no gains? Yes, maybe it may have been slow. We could have been at 35. But is it envisaged that we could have been anywhere beyond that? The budget question, Chair, I'm not going to touch, because budget changes all the time. It's influenced exactly by intelligentsia, by politicians, by society and all. So the budget, the dictum is funds follow function. So we can't start by putting the budget and therefore based on that begin to reason. Budget would follow what is social consensus and political consensus. That's just one aspect. The rest of Prof. She knows we're in agreement on the rest. Thank you.
Does any member wish to make a comment or raise a question? If not, I will take it back to Ruth.
Thank you, Chair. I'm surprised there's not more debate. I had aimed to provoke some debate, but I think I failed, except in one case. No, listen, I think that, first of all, just, Chair, in response to your initial comments, I think that it's very fair to say that debate within society is moving very clearly towards saying land reform cannot only be about agriculture and commercial agriculture. There are urban land issues. There's also a lot of potential for spatial, sort of overcoming spatial apartheid in urban centres, particularly using state-owned and parastatal land that is undeveloped and well-located. I think that's recognised. Secondly, this issue about land administration, I know that the chair of our panel, Dr. Vuyo Mahlathi of AFASA, is saying that, in fact, we should be recognising land administration as the fourth pillar of land reform. You know, that there is redistribution, restitution, tenure reform, but in fact, the land administration thing has been a sort of a systemic non-recognition of informal property rights. So we have to get that right. It's also a major source of tenure insecurity and conflict, the fact that people don't have clear and documented property rights. I think that you've said many things about overlapping rights on the same land, and I think that getting land administration systems right at a local level is part of resolving that. On the issues raised by Honourable Nguni, I hear you that on restitution it's not just a numbers issue, and that you know, for many people, resolving these claims either through restoration of land or through financial compensation is absolutely crucial. And so we need to think about some parts of restitution are land reform and some parts are not, because when we're paying out cash compensation, we are not resolving land inequalities, but still it's a historical grievance that has to be addressed. So I wasn't suggesting in any way that we abandon restitution. It's a constitutional right. But rather the question of, we need to recognize that slow progress with land redistribution has made people think that the only way in which to press their claims is via restitution. And this has also come up, you know, the Khoisan Leadership Summit happened some months ago. And their call was for constitutional amendment to turn back the clock prior to 1913. This is often raised. There are enormous practical and logistical questions about how to prove claims going back several centuries. But on the other hand, nobody would deny that there are traditional communities who wish to reassert their rights to territory. It's partly about getting recognition that this is where we're from. It's partly about historic recognition. It's partly about memorialization that this was our land. It's not necessarily the case that it all needs to go through restitution. And I think that this is where also we must remember that the Restitution of Land Rights Act empowers the minister to look at a claim that does not meet the criteria of the act and to use his or her administrative powers, executive powers, to acquire and allocate land to people who do not meet the criteria of the act. So I think that it's inaccurate to say that the minister's hands are tied. The minister's hands are free. But the minister has limited cash. That is an issue. I think I'll leave it there. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we do already have a legal precedent for pre-1913 claims. So thank you for the opportunity. I mean, I want to emphasize that how I would suggest...
Maybe before you close.
Yeah.
Thank you, Judge Sachs. Just to, maybe if you can comment as you are closing, you raised the experience of Brazil, land as a social function, and the application of that process, given the appetite of or limited appetite. Let me say, given the experience that we've had of mushrooming informal settlements everywhere, yeah. How would you manage that process in society? Because people can claim by going and staying there. Some landlords, as we saw in the mid-2000s, would allow for sheikhs to develop if they can't sell the land in an open market, and they will go to the state and say, there are people here now, I can't evict them, they are poor, and then the state... So kind of sheikh farming that was at some stage deliberately done. So I'm just saying, in the Brazil question, what would you say are the elements that are positive with that approach? Mm. And how has both the citizens and the state managed that area? The other matter I wanted to just check with you, maybe in the research that you had done, maybe not yourself per se, but maybe some of the colleagues in the field. Wouldn't you say that one of the weaknesses maybe with the section on redistribution is that it was demand-led, as opposed to a claim, like in the restitution claim, where people could literally mobilize and they can have a clear relationship with where they were moved, which is why maybe that process went faster as people were registering their claim. Whereas they may be hearing the state talking about redistribution, but I think the mechanisms may not be very clear. So people say, okay, they go to a land office, they say, I want land. And in most instances, the official will say, okay, which land have you identified? So it goes back that the citizen must go around looking for this farm and maybe don't have the capacity to do so and just gets defeated to say, okay, now if I have expressed the need, I have indicated what the I want the land for, but I'm being tossed around and sometimes when they go to the institutions of state, apart from the department, such as your land bank, the question is security. You know, there's no credit in the land bank. It operates like a bank. So you must show cause that you'll be able to manage a loan, even if somebody has reached that stage. But the process sometimes the land bank take to assess a loan makes a person just say, I know. So I'm just saying that wouldn't we say part of your redistribution element, its weakness is that it must be the one who needs, who must indicate. So the mechanisms are not quite clear, and maybe that's why people have not gravitated towards it, as opposed to tenure insecurity, because they've got a group of citizens that everybody can see that these are vulnerable, you know, communities who are staying in farm with insecure tenure, and partly because the issues of evictions have been much more visible, reported to by the media. The issues, particularly where a labor tenant has lost a family member, they can't bury in the farm. It ends up being, you know, a high-profile issue in the media and in the courts. So those two people can relate to, but this redistribution. So when you propose, as part of the panel, high-level panel, that we must have a redistribution legislation, how will it be in the law where you clarify the mechanism, or you would need a different policy framework that would enable people to actually relate to that land and to that program? So those are the issues that, for me, I would want you maybe to reflect on it. The experience of Kenya's land reform in the beginning, where actually it was not the state that entered into negotiations, but it was the citizens. So the state would give money to the people, and the people would offer their negotiations with the landowners. So the state was not your paramount negotiator. But it's because you were dealing also with people who were activists enough to be able to enter into those negotiations. Do you think there could be an experience in this regard? So some of these issues, it would be interesting, particularly as a researcher, to look at when you make comparisons of these different systems, what do you think could improve that element that we all say it may be a better way of fast-tracking land reform, redistribution?
Chair, you pose very challenging questions. So perhaps I can just briefly deal with Brazil. So I was at a very interesting conference late last year and went on a field trip to actually look at some of the land reform settlements. So what's interesting there is that, you know, there is a social movement. There is the MST, which is mobilized around this, and they have they stage encampments along the sides of the road. They identify vacant land, public or privately owned, that's being absolutely not used at all. And they have their own training schools. They're very organized. And, of course, what starts out as an illegal occupation over time can be confirmed. So they get certificates of occupation from the state, sometimes after several years. Now, the main thing is that, I mean, these are mostly poor people from the favelas who are occupying the land. And as long as that land is not being used, the owner is not effectively using that land, whether public or private, they are not immediately criminalized. But they have to show over time that they're using it effectively and that that land is now fulfilling a social function in order to get a certificate. So in a sense, it is a process that allows the mobilization of ordinary citizens to drive the process, and the state is the respondent. But where people are not using it, they will be evicted. And so that is broadly how it works. And I think that it would be useful if we can bring some of these debates, particularly from some colleagues from Brazil who've been following it and thought quite long and hard about what works and how it works and how it can be compatible with defense of property rights. You know, so we need to engage around that. On the issue of redistribution, I think you raise a very important question about demand for land. And you'll remember, of course, the National Land Summit of 2005 and this big push where people were saying, we don't just want a market-based approach where we wait for land to become available, offered for sale. We want to have a planned local approach. We want area-based planning. And so there were these experiments with area-based planning. The idea was that we integrate land reform into IDPs, and that people have an opportunity to express their demand. But of course, we know that municipalities don't want to have long waiting lists for agricultural land in the same way that they deal with the housing backlog, because that's a political liability again. So I think that we've effectively abandoned this area-based approach, and we've returned to buying up a farm here, a farm there. And what my research in at least two provinces suggesting, and also research by other colleagues, is that often it's not the evicted farm workers who manage to find out where property is available for sale. It's not the small-scale farmers with livestock in the communal areas. It's often people who are better resourced, better educated, living in cities, who are able to engage with these markets. So in many respects, I think it's a mistake that we say we have a market-based land program. We depend on the market, but it's highly bureaucratic and mediated by the state. So in a sense, we are beholden to the market, but constrained by the state as well. So I think that we really need to think about different approaches. That I think the most important thing is decentralizing. But with current capacity constraints within government, it's very hard to see how particularly national, provincial, and local government can work together in a better way. The redistribution bill, as is being discussed, would particularly focus on these issues around land identification, beneficiary selection, ensuring transparency and accountability in local processes, so that there is, in a sense, a way for people to claim this right of equitable access. But I think that we're not there yet. But finally, I think that what all of this suggests is that our constraints extend far beyond what is written in this important document, and that presumably there will need to be an ongoing process. We have a 1997 white paper on South African land policy. It does not describe in any way what actual policy is looking like on the ground. And I think that this political process of the past year has shown that this is an issue close to so many people's hearts. We need to think about a new and reinvigorated policy process. Thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Wow, all the presentations, members will agree with me, were really useful. They've helped us to clarify certain things in our mind. Our last presentation is Mr. Peter Meekin, a valuer, registered valuer, member of the South African Institute of Valuers and chairperson of SACPRIF Management Committee. When he listened to the news and heard that we're saying we're going to have experts, the same day he approached us and said, I am also an expert and I'm willing to be listened to. I must actually apologize that a number of members are also going, so the room is depleted, but you will have your show. I know. It's just that the sittings of committee in Parliament, which also involves some members, also happen on other days, so we get constrained to today. Over to you, sir.
Yeah. You can't sit there. That does not, you can't read that, can you?
Okay.
All right, Madam Chair, thank you for inviting me to talk to you. I'm a I started on this matter when the President said he wants to get this land question sorted out, and what was required was that lots more people must get to land, lots more people must be farming land, and there must be an increase in the economic activity, in the GDP. Well, that's my subject, and I hope that some of the things I'm going to say is useful to you. The first thing I have to say is that one of the aspects of expropriation is the price of land, and the price of land is going to come down dramatically. We know this because the Minister of Finance, in October, said that the income tax acts and VAT are terribly inefficient in the sense that they cost the country an enormous amount of money. I'll just give you an idea of what I mean by that. It's costing each of the 17 million families in South Africa about 60,000 rand a year to live. Which is inefficient. It's an impossible situation for them. But this is what Treasury has said. I'll get it up later for you on the screen. So, what it...
members, we will circulate the document so that if you are not able to... It's already in your email, so thank you very much.
Okay, good. Well, if you look at the red, there's a red graph, a red notice from the National Treasury. So what's going to be happening here is that in the next, I mean, it's an urgent matter. The Treasury has recognized that the income tax and VAT is terribly inefficient, so they're going to put in a land tax. That means the price of land will fall to... If they do it properly, it'll fall to a situation where the only thing that you pay when you take land is a recurring rent. Okay, so instead of paying 1 million rand for a piece of land, you'll be paying 5,000 rand a month or something. Now this has extraordinary ramifications, and it means that expropriation will become, because it goes back to the idea that the land does not belong to you or me. Did we make it? Did you make your land? I didn't. And if you didn't make it, or if you didn't ask somebody else to make it like you do a house, then on what right do you have to sell it and buy it? Do you get the question? Well, the fact is in Leviticus, which was the first time this was looked at, they say land will not be sold absolutely, for the land belongs to me, and you are only strangers and guests of mine. Now, very, very close to that, we have the Joshua Nkomo, who I've read a lot of critiques of land in the African tradition, but his, I think, is the best. It really repeats there, and I'll read it to you slowly. He's put this in a pamphlet. We don't believe in trading land or selling land, no. And in any government that I lead, you can be certain those practices will go. That does not mean we will be taking people's land. It means other people who haven't got money will have a chance to use land, which is the common property of everybody. And if they have to pay some rates or rent, as I've been talking about, that will go to a general fund of the people. That will go to National Treasury. In this way, citizens can use as much land as they want. Our system is this. Once you use land, that land belongs to you. But you have not bought it. You cannot sell it to someone. The land belongs to the people. But everything on that land is yours. So, this really can break the logjam here. And what I did is to write to the president after he'd said what he wanted to do. I wrote to him, and this is copyright, and told him that I'd prepared a constitutional lifestyle blueprint. And this is what he should do. And he can decree this. As far as I can understand, he doesn't have to wait for he could do it tomorrow if he wanted to. He doesn't have to wait for an election. He doesn't have to wait for the thing to go through the House. There are some corrections to the amplifications to Section 25, which will help. But what he needs to say then is to decree that National Treasury will substitute all income taxes and VAT with land rents. That's the rates and taxes users charge, and it'll be phased in over 5 years, starting in March 2020. He will then decree that everyone who is occupying, everybody, wherever they are, who is occupying 250 square meters of land or more, that's the minimum necessary for a frugally comfortable and self-sufficient lifestyle, and which they do not own or lease, is immediately granted perpetual tenure, forever. Wherever you are, whether you're on somebody's farm, wherever or if you're in the traditional areas, you'll be granted perpetual tenure of the land that you're then using. All that needs to be done here is that the neighbors must place boundary pegs in agreed positions for eventual registration.
Just a moment. I can see that almost all the members are leaving. And I was going to propose, if you don't mind, that you become our first presenter next week, if you will be available.
Well, it's better to have two people listening than 20, but
the challenge is that these are the members that will have to make
okay.
decisions on this issue. We can sit, the two of us, to listen.
No,
rest of the nine
okay.
have gone.
What date are you talking about?
It will be Friday next week.
Which is the 8th?
8th.
I think that's all right. Yeah, I think it's okay.
Okay, let's hear the other.
Oh, thank you. No, I just wanted to check first chair logistically where he stays. Oh, I support the chair's proposal subject.
Okay.
Thank you.
What would be your
fine.
I must really apologize because I wouldn't also want you not to be listened to by, you know, a number of people who would have to consider.
Well, that's encouraging. Well, I find that very encouraging.
Because what would happen, they can read, but it's good when somebody makes a presentation and they can engage with their presentation as we head with the three. I'm making a commitment as a chair that you will be the first one next week when we start the presentations.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Good.
Thank you very much, members, one member who's still remaining. I think this has been a very useful process. It's giving us, you know, most important views and reflections of the things that as a committee we must take into consideration. So our meeting is adjourned until next week, Friday at 9. We'll try and get to this very room if we can.
At 9 or 9:30?
9.
Was it supposed to be 9 today? Okay, sorry.
We started at 9.
Did you? I was late.
Okay. So next week at 9, we'll be back in this very room. If the room changes, we will advise which room will we use. Thank you very much. Adjourned until next Friday day.